welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. Almost a fortnight ago, the military establishment in Myanmar seized power after detaining Aung San Suu Kyi and her democratically elected leaders. This ended the country's 10-year dalliance with democracy that had followed decades of the junta rule. U.S. President Joe Biden recently threatened new sanctions, while the United Nations and United Kingdom condemned the coup. While India has taken a more calibrated approach, this move will certainly have a bearing on South Asia. To give us more insights into these developments, we have with us Dr. Avinash Palawal, Senior Lecturer in International Relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, University of London. He is also Deputy Director of SOAS South Asian Institute. He specializes in foreign and security policy analysis with regional focus on South Asia, Afghanistan, and Myanmar. Dr. Palawal has been extensively monitoring these latest developments, and we are happy to have him with us today. Thank you, Avinash, for joining us today. It's been quite an exciting time in Myanmar with the recent collapse of the democratic government there and the resultant power struggle between the military and civil leadership. Could you give us a little background on the key areas of conflict between them and how it led to the coup?
First of all, thank you so much for having me here for this podcast, Nitya. I'm deeply honored to be engaging with the Institute of South Asian Studies at the NUS in Singapore. And as you said, there's a lot happening in Myanmar at the moment, and not all of it is happy developments. In terms of the coup and some of the key salient areas that led to perhaps this sort of a military takeover of the civilian government in Myanmar, there are, I think, one of the major point of friction between the military and the civilian political leadership has been the constitution, the 2008 constitution of Myanmar. And this is simply because this constitution, which was born after a lot of protests and unrest between 2007 and 2008, which we know as the Saffron Revolution, where the monks basically came out for a variety of different reasons to the streets and began to protest the governance of led by the military-led governance at that point in time. That reform, the constitution that came, the reforms that occurred at the heels of those protests were never completely democratic in nature. That is simply because 25% of the parliamentary seats in Myanmar have been reserved for the military. And any amendment in the constitution would require more than 75% majority for an amendment to take place. This essentially leaves absolutely no space, even if a civilian political party wins all the rest 75% parliamentary seats, to actually make any serious structural constitutional amendment in the country. So basically, the voice of the people, as represented by elected civilian leaders, will never be able to translate into actual sort of change or in the country's political future. So this has been a long going tussle. And we have seen that ever since Aung San Suu Kyi, who's the leader of the National League of Democracy, a very powerful kind of political party, historically speaking, was very prominent after the 1988 democracy protests. She has been very popular since she came to power, and she won a handsome majority in 2015 after having boycotted the 2010 elections that took place after the transition of the post-2008 transition. She has been struggling to somehow revise or revisit the structural imbalance between the civil-military relationship. And this has often kind of manifested itself in demands of at least changing, if not reducing the 25% reservations for military, at least changing the benchmark for constitutional amendments, bringing it down from 75% plus to something in the range of 60s or 50s, which would allow some degree of equality or kind of constitutional equality to civilian elected leaders. But that has been anathema for the military leadership, especially in the form of the current senior general Min Aung Hlaing. There has been a lot of personality issues between, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi's leadership and Min Aung Hlaing. There have been a lot of ambitions and insecurities on both sides. Aung San Suu Kyi saw that you know, after having won another elections last year in 2020 with a handsome majority again, she saw this as an opportune moment to actually revise this fundamental imbalance between civilian and military leaders and institutions in Myanmar. But that was something that went against the conservative ethos of the Tamadaw. And this is perhaps why what led to a short circuit, so to say, in this relationship and, you know, led to the coup as we see. Of course, the structural sources of the coup are slightly complicated because one would wonder why would the military feel the need to overthrow a government when it already structurally is in power. But there were a lot of deep insecurities within this military leadership that Aung San Suu Kyi's sort of coup opting or outbidding on very stringent Burmese Buddhist nationalism, as we saw in the Rohingya crisis, also in the peace process, and which made no progress. She made sure that her popularity continued to increase. She even externally started building relationship with Beijing in particular, but not just. So she had much more space for maneuvering within the political landscape or the body politic of Myanmar itself. So that led to that insecurity or exacerbation of those insecurities within the military, despite having constitutional reservations.
So how would you assess the on-ground situation since Feb 1? Do you think the military will prevail, or is there considerable resilience in the democratic forces?
The situation on the ground is really grim, as we have seen over the past couple of weeks now. Almost there has been an incremental sort of the number of arrests of people who the military sees or views as dissidents, that has actually increased. They're going for wider sweeps than they did at the beginning, which was focused only on the leaders and certain powerful figures within the civil society, whether they were artists or filmmakers. I think the radius of arrests have increased, and it's not just limited to Naypyidaw and Yangon, but it's also kind of spread across the country. We have also seen fights break out in Shan State, and we have also seen other ethnic armed organizations prepping up militarily. So the situation on the ground as we speak is increasingly worsening. And when we talk of the ground, one thing I would like to sort of underscore is that there's a lot of focus on the protests and protests in urban centers especially, right? And this is very, very important because this is very, you know, the youth of the country, the, you know, people from across sectors are coming out and expressing themselves. So it's a very important voice. But there are also ethnic minorities, minority communities which have come out, and even ethnic armed organizations which have been part of the peace process, whether signatories or not to the national ceasefire agreement, they have also expressed their disdain against the coup. So as far as I'm concerned, this situation is escalating, not subsiding. In terms of the resilience, the question of resilience, I think the democracy protesters for now have shown considerable resilience to stay on the ground, continuing putting pressure on the Tamadaw, and doing so in a very kind of, you know, innovative ways, bringing in humor, bringing in, you know, making sure that these are peaceful protests, making sure that they don't turn violent, because that's not a wicket on which you can play when you're dealing with a military government. But at the same time, the way the senior general came and addressed the nation a few days back, it was very clear that the military is not in the mood of making a compromise. They have already given a timeline for 1 year, and they might take more than a year as well in terms of actually having any sort of managed elections, so to say. But the issue of resilience is not just about the protesters and those and the people who are not happy with the coup, but the resilience is also about how much staying power, politically speaking, does the Tamadaw has itself. And I think this is something very important to focus on. The Tatmadaw rank and file for now has not indicated, or even the top brass of the Tatmadaw, which historically has been driven by factions, has not demonstrated any cracks at the moment. I'm not saying that that shall remain, but for now it doesn't seem that Minon Lang is facing a rebellion from within, which is very important to kind of keep in mind. Second aspect which informs the resilience of the Tatmadaw, politically speaking again, is its contract with the Sangha. Buddhist nationalism is very potent in Myanmar, especially in the Bamar heartland of the country. And that means unless the state Sangha, the Mahanayaka committee, comes and takes a stand against the coup, which it hasn't done, And that silence is quite pronounced simply because just till one day before the coup, the committee had made sure of pushing forth the agenda of negotiations or a negotiated settlement rather than what they used the term heated arguments between the two sides. We haven't really heard from them.
So if both the army and Aung San Suu Kyi have played the Bamar nationalism card, what difference can the outcome make to the regime orientation, its approach to minorities and the Rohingyas issue?
The outcome is very critical, not just for the Rohingyas and the minorities, which I'll come to in a minute, but generally the people of Myanmar and the stability of the country, right? And that's something which is very central at stake here. Over the past 10 years, however imperfect the constitution might have been, one thing that came out very clearly is that there was a relatively healthier social contract between the leaders of the country, represented by civilian elected leaders, whether it was the USDP between 2010 and 2015 or the NLD-led government between 2015 and 2020. But there was a sense, if you go to cities like Yangon or Naypyidaw, there was a sense that the people were participating in politics and some decision-making, and the military, however powerful it might be, had taken a backseat. It had taken a structural role and left the day-to-day governance issues and policy-making in the hands of the elected representative, which was the state councillor Aung San Suu Kyi and her team. And that was something that gave certain degree of stability and an ability for people to think about the future in a much more open sense than they would have perhaps done in a previous kind of political formation when the Tapmadaw was running the country, right? There were daily freedoms which came to fore, which people had not enjoyed for a long time, having access to free internet, having access to, you know, expressing opinion on social media, especially Facebook, which is very important in Myanmar's kind of social landscape. These were newfound freedoms that people had come to cherish, they had come to appreciate. These were new spaces which were created for participatory politics. That basic fundamental freedom of expression, however imperfect it might have been, has actually, is at deep risk at the moment. And that contract, which I'm mentioning, actually provides strategic stability to the country, right? That is what made Myanmar, with all its problems, a little bit more attractive to neighbors and the world at large. You could think of Myanmar strategically and say, okay, we need to have a connectivity project, right? Indians and Chinese having connectivity project, they need stability in the country. You can't run a gas pipeline or build a road in a country driven by armed insurgencies or deep political protests going on all the time. So that's something that has completely been shaken. That contract has been torn apart exactly when it was coming to be a some degree of fruit or maturing a little bit. Having said that, apart from that, the issue of, as you asked, the minorities and the Rohingya. Now, this is where I'm a bit more circumspect, simply because, as you rightly noticed, that both Aung San Suu Kyi and the Tapmadaw actually began to outbid each other on the same political canvas of ethnic nationalism. Quite uncompromising Bamar Buddhist nationalism, both on an ethnic count and a religious count. So Christian non-Bamar minorities, whether represented by political, parliamentary political forces and political bodies or political parties which are not armed or militant, or represented or having sympathies for the ethnic armed organizations, they were in a dilemma either which way. In fact, they felt that Aung San Suu Kyi was doing much more disservice to the Panglong process or the peace process than even what the previous USDP government under former General Thein Sein had done. In fact, the irony of the situation is that the USDP government from 2010 to 15 was much more revolutionary in its limited sense of actually ushering in reforms and balancing Myanmar's foreign policy in favor against China in favor of the West than Aung San Suu Kyi herself. So neither the Rohingya nor the ethnic armed organizations and the ethnic communities would take much heart in either Suu Kyi coming back to power or Tapmadaw being, but the voices that we have seen come up from the ground is very clear that they'd rather have an elected civilian body to deal with, to have to talk to Aung San Suu Kyi 2.0 as she had won the elections, than to deal with a very insular, erratic policymaker in the form of the senior general. Because we simply, the Tapmadaw is an inscrutable organization to a certain degree. It's very difficult to put your bet on them both for the EAOs, for the Rohingya and their advocates, as well as the world at large, including its neighbors like China and India.
So do you think the international system can make a real difference to the internal struggle that's taking place in Myanmar now?
Depends on what and how you define the international system, Nitya, right? I would say there are various layers of interaction and points of influence between the domestic politics and the international kind of community, so to say. And in that, I'll include all the neighbors and the West, largely speaking. Now, let's start unpeeling this onion a little bit. Historically, the West, and I'm including European Union, United Kingdom, Australia, United States for sure, these countries have been very circumspect, and for good reason, of the Tapmadaw. And they have imposed heavy or kind of limited targeted sanctions at different points in time. And that is a practice that we have seen in the past couple of days intensify. Right, the number of sanctions, targeted sanctions against certain individuals, the number of individuals have increased within the Tapmadaw and other companies that they run. But the fundamental approach that they had, barring this brief opening up that we saw happening during the Obama administration, that has not actually changed. Both London had targeted sanctions against the senior general and the deputy senior general since 2018, if I remember correctly. So this is something that the Tapmadaw, when taking a decision of going for a coup, actually calculates. This is a reaction they expected, even the protests they must have expected. Then we come to the bigger neighbors in the region, right? One is, of course, ASEAN, then there is China, there's India, and most importantly, which often people tend to underestimate, are the countries like Russia and Japan. Now, India, China, and ASEAN, especially Thailand, these are countries which, having seen how important the military is, historically speaking, in the body politic of Myanmar, however much they feel for Aung San Suu Kyi or want participatory politics, whether it's democratic or not, or liberal or not at least, would not give up on channels of engagement with the Tapmadaw, because they know that if you do that, one, of course, you lose out in your own strategic posturing towards your own kind of ambitions in the region, but also you actually lose connect with the people. Because if you make enemies out of the Tapmadaw at this current point, you actually will do much more disservice to the people than do service to the people of Myanmar, who are facing a lot of severe repression as we speak. So neither China nor India would actually go out and, they're not happy with the situation, but they'll continue engaging with the Tapmadaw, which also means, this balancing act also means that it undercuts the importance of the potency of the protests on the ground to some extent, even if it's not intended to be the case, right? Because in many ways, the Tapmadaw would be like, okay, fine, if you're talking to us, you're not going to push us beyond the point, we know that. So that calculations have been done regardless of all the statements coming out at the UN. Then the third aspect, third layer again, and I think this is much more important and perhaps much less discussed, is the role of Russia and the role of Japan. Japan and Russia have over the past decade invested very heavily in Myanmar. In our Sinocentrism, we often look at China for good reason, and it's kind of, very powerful influence in Myanmar. But this coup is actually, it demonstrated the limits of Beijing's power in how much they can influence the Tapmadaw. The Russians have actually been training a lot and lot and lot of Tapmadaw officers and cadre in Russia for a long time. They have intensified their arms sales. Politically, they don't ask any questions. Their statement at the UN has been as blunt as it can be in favor of the generals. And this is something which has given Tapmadaw a much more stronger wicket to play on in the international domain. In fact, they are kind of playing China and Russia against each other and seeing which way the two countries, even if Chinese are unhappy till the time the Russians are on board. So this is something which I think will get clearer as time goes by, but I would say that Russia has played a very powerful enabler's role as far as the coup goes. Japan, on the other hand, has a different history with Myanmar, going back to the Second World War, the kind of destruction that was wrought as part of the Japanese kind of conquest and then kind of retreat from Burma, as it was then called. And Tokyo has always maintained some degree of relationship with the generals. And the idea has simply been that, look, you cannot deal with the country without talking to the generals, even for the betterment or poverty reduction endeavors or having some conflict resolution going, you need to talk to the generals. So over the past few years, we have seen a very strong uptick in Japanese aid and infrastructure support to Myanmar, which gives them a lot of political capital as well. And this is where Japan becomes important, because it was a Japanese envoy who actually was able to get the Arakan army and the Tatmadaw to sit together and cut a deal, which is quite ironic, which is quite something, because this was an ethnic armed organization which was giving a whole lot of bloody nose to the Tatmadaw in the past 3-4 years. And it has staying power, it is well armed, it has a lot of public support across Rakhine, is also operating in Chin state, and was designated as a terrorist organization by the Tatmadaw. And yet, in the last few months, we have seen them come out of that shell and cut a deal and said that, look, we'll hold elections in parts of Rakhine, which we were not able to hold elections in. So there's a lot of back and forth going, a lot of different political actors which are taking very different stances. So there are as many enablers of this coup in the international system, as many kind of those countries who are trying to push against it and trying to make sure that the democratic transition does not fall by the wayside.
That was a very interesting explanation, and you've elaborated it very well. But we will have to talk about China and its growing weight in Myanmar in the recent years. We saw President Xi visit Myanmar early last year. So how do you assess China's role in the current dynamics?
China has always been very important in the history of Myanmar, especially, I would say, post the 1988 moment, when you see that the isolation that Burma faced because of the crackdown against the democracy movement, it gravitated it even, you know, at the peril of India in the arms of China, strategically speaking. And since then, there hasn't been never really been a looking back as far as China is concerned. In terms of Chinese presence, of course, contemporary kind of presence has been articulated in the form of China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, which is one of the many corridors, you know, within the larger rubric of the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a, you know, strategically consequential initiative, as we have kind of been studying and looking at for the past few years. But there is another aspect of China's influence and the way it has kind of nearly penetrated kind of Myanmar society, is that it has almost captured most of the markets in Myanmar, right? A lot of, especially in the border regions, a lot of the daily products, soap, salt, food products, they're coming from China. And this is something that gives some degree of influence and leverage. And Chinese interlocutors, they have a special envoy, but they have a huge team under the special envoy, which would be engaging separately with all ethnic communities. So you are looking at a very kind of a multi-pronged approach, both bottoms up and top down, as far as Beijing goes, in terms of how it deals with Myanmar. And that's simply because Beijing has understood that you have to talk to the generals, but they are not the only, you know, power center in this country. You have to talk to the ethnic armed organizations. You have to talk to the people in Kachin or Shan state, because they have a peculiar relationship with the armed organizations, without whose consent you will not be able to build the railway line in Shan, or you cannot build the Mitso Dam in Kachin. So they have had they've diversified their presence, especially since 2015, part of that diversification was also investing a lot in Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD herself. So when the coup happens, it was almost, and this is something that was very, it was not very well taken by the Tatmadaw. Minong Lang, senior general Minong Lang, did not take Chinese presence and such kind of diversified intense presence in Myanmar very kindly. There's a lot of public mistrust against China in Myanmar. And even within the Tatmadaw, it's a very kind of deep-rooted mistrust, because they see China as an interventionist power, unlike India, which can take wrong policy decisions in their view, but has never really, stepped on the sanctity or the territorial sovereignty integrity of Myanmar as such. This was something which was not accepted by Minong Lang. So when the coup actually happens, again, it's early days to put a very strong pin on that empirically speaking, but what the Chinese reaction was more of recalibrating its policy towards the new developments, as seen in them using the term internal affairs or cabinet reshuffle, rather than being well on board or giving a kind of a silent signal behind the scenes before the coup took place. So it also shows the limit of what China can do. The reaction from the Tatmadaw post-coup has also been very interesting. They have been you know, categorizing different countries in terms of allies, you know, neutrals and enemies. And West, of course, is in the enemy category. The neutrals could be ASEAN and some other countries, Japan, and but there are allies, and Russia, China, and India are all considered, ironically, allies, despite India's kind of statements against the Taliban and against the coup. So this is how I think China has a lot of presence to kind of wrap up on that question. But there are limits to how much it can influence the domestic politics. At best, at most, China can hedge. And that's what we have seen.
But India also seems to have taken a very calibrated approach in reacting to this development in Myanmar. It has, of course, underlined the restoration of democracy without being aggressive and calling for reconciliation. So do you think this position is sustainable and in tune with its deeper interests in Myanmar?
I think so. In fact, just today at the UN, the Ministry of External Affairs has taken a very clear stand, called for release of all the, you know, political prisoners. I mean, people who have been detained, including Aung San Suu Kyi. They have considered deep concern. They've articulated deep concern even in the first statement. So I think it is calibrated, but it's also fairly strong in terms of what they're trying to communicate as far as the principles are concerned. There's very clear preference for the kind of social contract that I mentioned earlier in India, where there is electoral kind of democracy. India understands that democracy in Myanmar has never been a liberal experiment. It's been an electoral experiment, and it's been an ethnic experiment in many ways, perfectly or imperfectly speaking. But that experiment is much more palatable than what we have come down to since 1st of February at post-coup. And I think that preference is very clear. So that is something, as we move on, we'll see India taking a stand in terms of supporting the people of Myanmar, in terms of, you know, wanting the respect of the political opinion and the voices that are coming out of the street. But at the same time, they will do what they have to do, and that is engage with the Tamado. I think part of India's diplomacy would be to also impress upon the Tatmadaw, without short-circuiting their own relationship with the military junta, that this kind of participatory inclusive politics, whether it's within the Bamar dominated lowlands of Myanmar or in the ethnic periphery, so to say, or the borderlands, you know, it is actually in their national interest. And that is simply because resolving, or at least, you know, heading towards the resolution of these deep-seated civil-military imbalances, ethnic imbalances, religious imbalances, whether it's, you know, the Buddhist-Muslim issues or Buddhist-Christian issues, that would actually impart much more stability to the country itself and would actually strengthen and increase the respect of the military as an institution as we move forward. What we see in a coup is not the signs of a strong state. What we see in the coup is a sign of a deeply vulnerable and a highly weak state. And this is something I think the Indian diplomats would be working to impress upon, however effective or ineffective they might be in reality. But that is something I think they'll work and continue working towards. Let's also not forget that India has its own kind of very clear security interests with Myanmar, right? This insurgency, historically speaking, in Northeast, although at much lower levels today than it was in the 80s and 90s, or even before, during the 60s. But it's never good to have unrest in Myanmar, because it only offers more space for insurgent groups, whether it's the Nagas, the Métis groups, or the Bodo, whoever it is, right, to use that territory for R&R, for shelter. And then kind of, you know, historically, we've also seen Myanmar as a conduit to Yunnan and China. So it offers space to external actors in India's internal issues, which makes India quite legitimately concerned. There is also the ambition that India has in terms of having economic connectivity to Southeast Asia through Myanmar, and having more economic connections for its own Northeast economic development through Myanmar and Bangladesh. The coup makes India nervous, simply because, not because they don't have channels with the Tatmadaw, simply because the situation on the ground would not be conducive for meeting these interests, even if India has channels with the Tatmadaw. And I think that is the balance really that we are talking about. It's less about whether you can talk to the generals or not. It's more about what the generals actually do to the country.
We also saw the Biden administration recently announce the imposition of sanctions. And this issue also figured in the conversations between President Biden and Prime Minister Modi. So how does India balance its position between the Western pressures and its own interests in Myanmar, something that you mentioned in your answer, your previous answer?
I think they've already started to, especially today, let me remind, especially today as a non-permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, India will be balancing its global image, its global partnerships, especially, you know, with the US and the incoming Biden administration, and its kind of more immediate interests in the region and domestically speaking, as far as Myanmar's kind of body politic goes. Internationally, the statement that India made at the UN today, the kind of posturing it has done in terms of supporting democratic transition, this is something that India will continue to operate on as far as the statements and the posturing, policy posturing goes. And I think that is something that the Biden administration will take well. And because there is history for that, it was during Vice President Biden and President Omar Mustenyo when the opening up to Myanmar happened. And this, there was some degree of coordination between India and the United States at that point in time when the opening up was happening, 2008, 2011, even afterwards, right? I think having said that, given India's own interests and its continuing desire to engage with the Taliban, I think there would be limits to how far India would go if tomorrow Biden administration decides to expand the ambit of sanctions, let's say. If the sanctions become more wider and impact the economy of the larger population, which actually they don't right now as much as one would have expected it to be. They're very well-calibrated, targeted sanctions. And I think Indians are very fine with that. That is something which is actually quite legitimate. In fact, India can utilize the pressure being put by the West to impress upon the Taliban to kind of, you know, figure out a slow but sure reversal of the coup and make progress towards more participatory politics. It's a tool that India can use both in terms of its own relationship with the West as well as in its conversations with the Taliban. And this actually, this balancing act fits very well with the larger framework of Indo-Pacific, right? When you're having countries like the Quad countries come up and trying to counterbalance this China-Russia sort of compact in this region, these are the kind of pressures which would actually enable India to assert itself a little bit more without having to take the baton of coercion itself, as it did during Rajiv Gandhi's tenure in 1988, when it went quite aggressively in favor of the democracy movement and realized that it had actually miscalculated and that the Taliban had much more staying power than it thought it did in the heat of the moment. So I think it's a very calibrated game, I believe. Conscious or not, I'm not sure, but I have reason to believe that it's not entirely coincidental either.
I think you gave us many interesting perspectives. Thank you very much for joining us at South Asia Chat. It was a pleasure having you today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You are listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. Thank you.